A couple of weeks ago, one of the horticulturists at Duke was, I was looking for some plants, and he told me about this place out in Angia, North Carolina, that you get plants, all kind of fancy trees and plants for, for a minimal cost. And it's kind of an area that has nurseries all up and down the highway. So I went out, Diane and I went out to get some plants, and I drove up in this kind of big husky, white guy, who was friendly and nice enough to me, came up and I said, well, I'm looking for some different trees, rhododendrons and whatnot, and he said, I got plenty of them, what size do you want? And I said, well, I want a couple of small ones and a couple of medium ones. And there were Hispanics who obviously did a lot of the work for him, and so he looks at one of the Hispanics and he said, why don't you boys go out there, and these was obviously grown men, he said, why don't you boys go out there and pick him out a couple for him to look at. And he said it in a very demeaning way. And I think what that did for me was kind of reinforce that all these things we talk about that we think are somehow far, far away from our current reality are really but a blink of the eye away. And given an opportunity, they would resurface overnight. And I saw that with this new group that's kind of emerging. You have Latinos and Hispanics or, in the area. And this guy's ability to regress and talk to these young men, as I saw, white men talk to my grandfather, was one of the most daunting experiences that I've had, in recent times. It's like, my goodness, and so daunting that, I couldn't respond. I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't feel comfortable having this guy go get plants and having been called that, so other than to try to treat this person very nice and to be very thankful for the work that he was doing and reinforcing him as a human being. But I think this is important stuff, because if we don't learn to look at it and understand what happened and really try to digest those realities, it's doomed to repeat itself, and we're doomed to not find the solutions, because obviously we haven't done that. I don't think Chapel Hill High School has really resolved the problem of how do you educate, how do you create success for, particularly for people from poor backgrounds, and that's still one of the issues in education. I think Lincoln High had a lot to offer in that regard, because we were by and large a group of poor kids, various levels of poverty, but we were all poor kids. And I think it did that you have people like Thurman Couch, who left here and went to a Big Ten university. You have my brother, who went to a university and was basically, even at UNC, people awed his intelligence. There were things there that we need to try to hear and learn about. You have my brother now, who grew up in what probably more poverty than people realize, we were in. But we always had books to read. We always had encyclopedias. We always had, loving parents and food and a family that reinforced education. And so I just think there are things there that hopefully people will look at and listen to, because I think there are answers to some of the complex issues that we're researching in great institutions. There are answers there. And I appreciate very much how people idealize that experience at Lincoln, because there were great things there. There were great things. And I think it's a story, I think it is a story to be told. But what would be interesting? The other side of your documentary should be talking to some of the white counterparts to see what their experience was, what they remembered about the experience. I'd love, maybe if you don't do that, maybe I'll do it, to see what was their reality, what was going on in their mind, and because we did have, I failed to mention, there was a group that has some title of race relations type group.
Give me the names of some white students you remember, and I'll try to add them to this. I have interviewed a few white people here, two students so far. One who did a documentary on the black community, I thought that she would be sensitive to what went on, but it turns out that she was having her own rebellion and really didn't remember a whole lot of what.
Well, there are people around. Alexander Julian was around, who's actually...
Was he back in the community?
I don't know where Alexander is these days. I mean, he used to be in and out. I've run into him a couple of times. But Don Fuller was a physician here at UNC for many years. I was at Michigan once, and I was at the bus stop, and Michigan's a very cold climate, and you just don't recognize people because you all kind of bombed it off. And this woman, white woman, that I went to high school with, and I never knowingly knew her, but recognized her face after she recognized me. And, Michigan's a huge school. This woman runs over to me, and she gives me a hug. And goes, oh, my God, I can't believe you're here. And it was just like a moment in time when the strangeness of Michigan and that big environment kind of overwhelmed us with the closeness and intimacy that came from, the common background, even though our paths were so different. And she was very, very nice woman to me, and totally blanking on her name, but we'd frequently drive back to Chapel Hill together, or took a couple of trips back here together. And I always thought that was kind of something that probably if you had asked me, I would have said it was such a cold, callous reality. But there were decent people out there, on the other side, who probably wanted to reach out for us, but didn't know how. And she would have been an example of that. Peter Gelblum was another guy that, I thought he was a wonderful spirit, and I ran into him, and just the warmth that came from the interaction told me that probably in this strange world that we were existing in, we didn't really connect, but we connected, without knowing it, that the experience somehow had enriched us. Because the energy, that I felt when we kind of just ran into each other was just unbelievable. Not being a stranger in a university will almost force anybody together. But it was just a kind of a special interaction. And it's kind of that's the only two times that I remember running into some of my white counterparts. And that, I guess, gave me something special, because I think one of the things we get from the white world is a sense of coldness, and we don't get that natural nurturance. And I particularly, in fact, I work at Duke University now, and one of the reasons I thought I chose to get out of the corporate world was because I was just the brittleness of that coldness that I was experiencing day after day after day. I just thought it was beating, my humanness down, and just making me a bitter person, and I wanted out of it. And I thought I would go to Duke and it would be less like that, but it's kind of some of the same dynamics. But I guess there were good people there, but we couldn't connect because the setting wasn't, the preparation hadn't been done, for us to really connect and really benefit from each other's experience. But even back then, I can remember going to white people's homes, and in fact, Don Fuller, who is a Southern guy and a Southern Baptist, and we would sit up at his house late into the night and talk about politics. In fact, some of these uprisings, we talked about them at his house, and because out of this, I think some of the white people who were of like mind or sensitive to the cause tried to dialogue with us. And he'd been an interesting person, because I can remember that his parents probably, and he told me once that his parents were reasonably prejudiced, but that they let us set up in his living room and kind of talk all this stuff. I thought, like, wow, that's pretty amazing, you know, that that would have been, that was indicative of something, you know.
Let me take you back, and it, unless you want to go on with
no.
this, I got the feeling that you were struggling with it for a little bit there. There were a couple of questions I wanted to ask you, several more questions, if you
sure.
have the endurance.
Yeah.
I think I'm fading before you are.
Okay, ask me a question.
One is Gloria Register
okay.
Jeter.
Register, okay.
Said that she went to the principal with a list of demands and walked out of the principal's office feeling, with a couple of other students, she didn't remember what the demands were, but she left the principal's office feeling that none of the demands had been met. And people were in the hallway, and she said that the message went like wildfire, and that's what the spark was that set off the uprising.
If Gloria said that, then I have 100% trust in her reality, because she was an integral part of that, and was definitely someone that was a good articulator of our position. So I don't remember that reality, but given my memories of how we were operating during that period of time, I think that was very likely that Gloria and some people did go to the principal, and the principal did reject those realities, because Gloria was very well liked, very bright, articulate, and had been appointed by peers as a leader, and people would have listened to her. I don't remember that, but I'm sure that it happened like that, and I just don't remember it. Because there were a lot of things that led up to this. I can remember getting together on Sundays, and there was a political group at UNC, and we never knew whether they were like planted to kind of the State Bureau of Investigation to kind of get inside information of whether we should really trust them, and we spent a lot of time talking about that. But they advised us a lot on what to do and how to organize. And you kind of supported us. I know Preston Dobbins was one of the big leaders of the movement on UNC's campus. And that was one of the other driving forces, is that UNC was in uproar during that period of time. And black students at UNC were making demands. So we modeled ourselves after them, that, you know, it kind of empowered us to, you know, even know that you could make demands or that you should make demands. And we spent a lot of our time down on campus supporting them, and then we'd go back and get ideas on things that we could do. But I'm sure that happened, that the word, but you have to understand the dynamics was that it was going to burst. And we were just looking for the right moment. So we were looking for the right moment, and it was going to happen during that period of time.
The other issue that I wanted to revisit was Thurman Couch's perception that the reason there wasn't more of a disturbance the first year was that he and a group of other students who were on the football team kept people in line. And I remember you saying to me during the interview that you blocked out a lot of the memories from the first year, but I wonder if you remember any of that. What kept things in line that first year? Because most of the people I've interviewed said to me that the walls became obvious the second year and the third year of the integration of the high school.
See, I always saw the dynamics a little different. I think we had been conditioned to white folks, you know, to be polite, to do what we were asked to do, to not act out, to be pleasant. I mean, we learned those lessons at a very early age, pretty much from our parents working for them, the way we had to do things like get ready for the symphony when we were going to be exposed to white people. So I always thought during that first period of time we were on our best behavior, you know, like, we got to act right out here, you know. And we frequently got those kind of messages. I remember when they integrated the theater, the Varsity Theater downtown. In our class, the next day, we had a lecture about how we should act when we go to the theater. The teacher told us that she had heard that somebody had gone to the movie that weekend and was walking up and down the aisle, and you absolutely should not do that, you know, and just gave us a lecture on what to do and what not to do, and you know, make it rough for the other people. And so I think you get those scripts when you grow up black. So I always thought, you know, we had the script, and it took us a while to say, no, this is not right. You know, we don't have to do that. Now that may, I'm sure we followed the lead of Theremin and those guys who were playing football, who were stars in the football team, and I guess that will end it. Who, you know, were leaders. You know, so probably, you know, if that was his position, that, you know, like, be okay, or things are going to be okay, if that was the message he was sending. But I don't know. I don't remember listening to that message. I remember just kind of this culture, this environment, and trying to adjust to it and settle in. And once I settled in, got accustomed to just the routines and the realities, that we began to react to them. But it was just cultural shock. I mean, you couldn't. Got to get used to what's out here and how things were done, and once you got used to that and you learned the ropes, the second year, it was like, well, we're not going to do this anymore. This is not happening. But you know, I don't remember the interesting thing. I don't remember any black administrator supporting us. I don't remember any of them, you know, coming to say don't do it, or to say, you know, we support you, or we agree with your demands. And I can understand why they wouldn't have. I mean, they had families to support, but I don't remember. Wade DeGraffenried was the only black member on the school board during that period of time, and he was exceptionally supportive and understanding and compassionate. And in fact, a couple of times when I you know, got into trouble, you know, he was a guy that, he's a big brother that you would want to call, get you out of trouble, then I'll talk to you about what you did. And he was very compassionate to our struggle, gave us leadership, but also, you know, compassion and a willingness to validate some of the things that we were doing. But other than him, I don't remember. Hilliard and R.D. Smith, R.D. Smith was just, he was adamantly against it, adamantly against it. Mr. MacDougall probably was a silent supporter, you know, would have been my read on it, James Pease. But, what other question, what was your other question?
Well, there are two others that I can recall right now. But one is the outside support that came to you, and also the outside support that you gave to other schools. You mentioned Preston Dobbins, a leader at UNC, and the fact that you supported UNC. UNC was uprising, and they were supporting you.
Absolutely. But they gave a space to meet, or you know, they meet with us down on campus. And
so that's where you did your planning.
Well, that was our gathering spot. It was also, we went to the library on campus, so they got us access to some of those settings that we you know, were foreign to, you know. So that they were definitely supporters. I don't remember any of the elitist members of the community supporting us. I remember some of the people that Keith would call we, you know, the parents of poor children supporting us, you know, but none of the kind of big, you know, black people in the community, you know, the educated, the well-to-do, middle-class blacks. I don't remember any support whatsoever. I don't even remember any support from Hilliard, from your cop, what's his name?
Ed Cole.
Ed.
Yeah. Now, didn't you have a meeting that night after the riot?
Yes, we did. I can't remember anything about it, but we did. And we had a meeting and then a meeting at a parent's, at my friend Shirley Tuck's house. And her parents were very supportive, very supportive. Absolutely, you need to do that. And they were very conservative people. That was the interesting thing, that they were so conservative and disciplinarians and protective and, you know, but her mother realized that we needed to do something. You know, and she supported us. Betty's parents, they supported us. My parents didn't, because they were so conservative, religious, you know, but you know, they did not support us, though. They just didn't support us. And the white folks, it's interesting that they worked for, would make comments to them about it. And I always respected that they never bought into that. You know, it's kind of like they heard it, but it went in one ear and came out the other. And for me, that was kind of a sign of support. And my grandmother worked for a fairly well-known professor on campus. And I mean, he's dead now, but Paul Guthrie is an economics professor, and they would make comments about things that they'd heard that we were doing or encouraging other people to do, you know, kind of would put a negative label on it. But I think they respected that we needed to stand up. But the interesting thing is that the elite, I mean, there was a minister in town, I think J.R. Manley was supportive. He's one of my people. I mean, a lot of people, I like him. He's always been particularly nice to me. A lot of people didn't. And that's one of the interesting guys, you know, you have Mr. Pierman, he's never been one of mine. You know, I was not an athlete. He's much too harsh of a man, you know, for me. You know, I needed a much more gentle spirit to kind of connect with. And so Mr. McDougall, James Pease, my brother loves Mr. Pierron. I mean, I would never say anything about him. But just that I didn't, you know, and that's a good, healthy community should have that. There's somebody for everyone. I mean, it's a dysfunctional community if you only have one leader, you know. So J.R. Manley, there was a young minister at St. Joseph's Church. He was very supportive.
Not Mr. Eubanks.
Way before his time. In fact, we had planned to have the graduation ceremonies for black students at St. Joseph's had they gone ahead with the model of having two white marshals lead the senior class, and we were not going to participate. It was not going to happen. And that's the reason they did it. We were going to disrupt the graduation and have our own ceremonies. And to the person, everyone agreed with that, and we were very sad and heard about that and talked about that a lot. We'll never have another graduation. We won't have this experience. It's a once-in-a-lifetime thing, and we give this up. You know, what are we going to do? What are we going to think, you know, 50 years from now? But we all were willing to concede that reality to for the good of the greater good.
When you had the uprising, the protest, did any of the white students get beat up?
I think so. And you know, for the longest period of time, I would see a couple of the white students around town, and I could feel their anger. And I think one guy even made comments to me, you know, he'd give me the finger. And I mean, I was an adult far beyond this reality. there was, it was not endorsed necessarily by the movement, but there were some people who acted out their aggression in that manner. Mm-hmm.
Interesting, it wasn't in the newspaper. At least I can't find an account of that. And from what I heard from others I've interviewed, no one was hurt badly. But the perception was that the verbal abuse and some of the physical abuse all but disappeared after that. Do you remember any of that?
Don't remember that. But I see what happened. It was there were ones of us who kind of articulated the movement, organized the movement, were spokespersons. And then there were people around who were not in the forefront who did more of those kinds of things. And that's what a good movement should do. You shouldn't have your leaders, you know, getting in vulnerable situations. So it was kind of one of the dynamics of those kinds of uprisings, is that you have people who are not necessarily in the forefront do some of that work, and then the movement continues to go on.
Last thing, I know we have to leave here. I look at the two cultures as very different from what people have told me. The perception was that the black community had... The black school had rules and regulations, dress code, behavior code, demerit system, the use of the switch. No smoking on campus, certainly no alcohol, no gum chewing, no hand holding, no kissing out in the schoolyard. And you went to a new school where people smoked in the schoolyard, maybe surreptitiously, where there was even alcohol in the schoolyard, certainly surreptitiously. Kids could wear hats in the school, hand-holding, making out on campus. Someone even described boys and girls rolled up in a blanket lying on the grass. That kind of a liberal culture. Is that reality? Is that what you saw?
Yes, but I always thought that the other school was too repressive in that regard. So I'm probably in the minority in that I wasn't attracted to that kind of repressive behavior, you know, at Lincoln or in the other school. I thought that's one of those things I talked about initially. I just thought it was stepping over boundaries that, you know, you just didn't need those kind of boundaries there. But yes, absolutely, it was more liberal and much more conservative at Lincoln. But I'm not sure that we got anything out of that. I mean, I'm not sure that that yielded anything. I mean, in terms of real things. I mean, did it decrease the teenage pregnancy rate? Did it improve academics? I don't know.
I was bringing it up as an issue of sort of culture shock, that you were moving into an environment. Well, but maybe you knew all of that, because a lot of the students walked right by Chapel Hill High School to get to Lincoln. I mean, those were...
No, I don't think... But see, because I was younger, I probably hadn't been as indoctrinated by that Lincoln way of doing things. So it didn't have as great an impact on me because I was in a much younger generation. If you had gone through, you know, the ranks at Lincoln, and let's say you were in that Thurman Couch class, then you'd have experienced more of that indoctrination, or the class before Thurman. I never got Lincoln indoctrinated. So I didn't... Chapel Hill High was more my indoctrination because that's where I came of age at. So that's kind of more of, there's probably a separate kind of reality. I bet you're hearing that more from the people are 2 or 3 years older than me. I didn't.
Let me ask you, and maybe we'll need to answer this outside the library, but if there's anything more that you would like to add that I haven't talked about or that we have talked about that you want to expand on.
back.
We go out and discuss that outside.
Sure.
I really appreciate your...
Sylvester, thank you so much for the interview. As I have with everyone I've interviewed, I'd like to hear if there's anything that you want to go back over or anything new that you want to add or just say regarding your history, your remembrances.
No, I don't have anything else. I guess my only thought is that I'm a little sensitive to those comments about poverty, because I don't like for people to take my reality out of its context and label it with their own stuff. So I'll be interested in your document, and looking at any comments that you take about that, because, I guess I hold my grandparents in particular, and my mother in the highest regards, and I don't want anything to ever reflect as a lack of appreciation on what they've done for me in my life. So short of that, you can record it anyway, but I don't have anything. But I will, if I got your email address, if I think of other things, as I will, I'll write you.
Thank you.